So it's good being here. I'm just discovering this here. I started at the university about a year ago. I'm just discovering the joys of teaching myself, and should probably be taking notes from all of you. I was up until about 10 last night, sort of proctoring my first final exam. I'm hoping that the students all pass the final exam. And I had not realized that you could be just as nervous being the person giving the exam as the students are themselves. Anyway, there's a lot to learn. And I hadn't appreciated this, partly explains why my voice is running a bit dry today. I hadn't appreciated, I think some of the interesting issues involved in teaching physics. I just hadn't really thought about these things before until this year. So this is a talk that I prepared a lot of material for originally for just the public. It's just a sort of public talk. But if at any point you want to, you know, stop me and ask about some of the physics material, I think the main message I got from some of the training the university does in teaching is that it's actually quite hard to teach math and physics and science, because it involves a very deep understanding of the material, much deeper than you think. And from that point of view, I think it's good to, you know, really, if you have any puzzles or questions about, you know, the expanding universe, cosmology, how these things all fit together, you can try asking me. I may or may not be able to answer them very confidently. But anyway, it's really, you know, it's good to sort of down into these things. So let me just give you an overview of what I was going to talk about. I wasn't going to mention so much of the Cosmos work because I assumed Damien had talked to you a bit about that. I'll mention a bit about that later on. I have some other pictures I can show you of that. We just had a meeting of the Cosmos Collaboration, so that was interesting, at the Hayden Planetarium in New York, which is one very good resource for teaching materials in this field. So I thought what I'd talk about is, first of all, to just give you an overview, a reminder of what the different sort of scales and structures are in the universe, since this may not be as familiar to you as it is to me by now. I was going to review the evidence for dark matter. I think you've gone over a fair amount of this before, so that bit I may go through slightly faster. And then there are one or two slight sort of digressions I want to get into, which are more closely related to my work or my personal interests. These have to do with what dark matter does when you leave it out there on its own in the universe. And finally, I think the thing that makes all this very exciting scientifically is that the pace at which we are discovering things in this particular field is really accelerating tremendously. For a long, long time, when I was a student, certainly, this was a subject that seemed like it might remain unresolved for decades. We now have two or three big experiments that are within a year or two of starting that should really advance this subject tremendously, helping us to identify what dark matter is. And I think if we can pin it down to a specific particle, in particular, that will really sort of bring it into the fold of conventional physics in a way it hasn't been so far. I'll try to explain to you how it is we could study something, but, you know, whose identity we don't know. That may seem a little counterintuitive. Okay, but let me start by reminding you of what the universe around us looks like. So this is what the universe around us looks like. This is a pair of Messier objects that you could see with a small telescope. They're clusters of stars that have all formed at roughly the same time, fairly young stars. And more generally, you can see a field of other stars around them. Rather nice picture off the Astronomy Picture of the Day website, which I highly recommend. It's good as a screensaver, too. So space, you know, basically consists of small amounts of, oh, actually, I should use the hockey sticks here. The Perimeter Institute, and this is a bit of a convention. Not quite sure. I think I'm supposed to use this to point. So space consists of small, bright things surrounded by or separated by large bits with nothing in them. You know, that's the summary of all of astronomy. So there you go. You now know pretty much the structure of the universe. So just to point out one or two details, these small bits of stuff are normal matter. This is often called baryonic matter in the field. Baryons technically are a subcategory of particles that includes basically protons and neutrons. So most of the mass of normal matter in the universe is in protons and neutrons, basically. There are also electrons, of course, that are needed to make the universe electrically neutral. Those don't have anywhere near as much mass. But baryonic matter is a shorthand for matter particles. And the thing that makes baryonic matter solid is the electromagnetic force. On the other hand, baryonic matter can be charged. As I say, they're protons and electrons that have opposite charges. And on the whole, in the universe, part of the universe, we see that charge is balanced out so that large objects like these are stars, so they're things that are, you know, roughly a million times more massive than the Earth, say, are electrically neutral. And the only force they really respond to is gravity as a result. Gravity is very weak relative to electromagnetism, but electromagnetism can cancel out because there are plus and minus charges that can cancel each other, whereas gravity can't cancel out. We don't know of negative masses unless you use solid-state physics, the complications that I won't get into. So all this is normal matter organized by gravity, separated by really big gaps with almost nothing in them. The scales involved are very hard to appreciate. You can think about this in terms of scale models. I've seen good explanations in terms of objects like, you know, basketballs or oranges or things like that that you put at a given distance to try to explain even, say, the scale of the solar system. One of the questions I was once asked was, if I got in my car and drove to the sun, how long would it take? The answer is it would take a long time. I think the answer is somewhere in the weeks or months. It depends a bit whether you feel like you have to stop for gas, whether the car just coasts or whether you keep on accelerating and so on. And you might feel, since there's no roadway, that it can be actually quite hard to accelerate at all and so on. Anyway, it's 150 million kilometers just from us to the sun. So even the solar system is quite big. Here's the solar system up at the top of this. These figures won't reproduce particularly well. They're just really there to give a very broad brush sense of the scales involved. So here, this is the inner solar system with the orbits of the planets put in. This is the outer solar system, factor of about 10 times bigger. Here, the scales are the light travel times involved are minutes. It's about 8 minutes from us to the sun. Here, they're getting up for hours. Here, if we zoom out again by another factor of 10, we can see the orbit of Pluto, and then we see nothing else. We now know that actually there are smaller bodies out in this outer part of the solar system. We've actually identified some of them. In fact, Pluto is simply a representative of a much larger class of objects. If you went out by another factor of 10, here again, it looks like there's nothing. We think there's a structure up there called the Oort cloud that's the reservoir of long-period comets, for instance. And it's really the debris that the solar system flung out during its formation. So we'd expect to see this around other stars that have planets in them. Basically, the planets interact, and they eventually fling out smaller bodies as part of that interaction while the solar system is forming. I say we would, in principle, expect to see this around other stars. It's very hard to see. These bodies are very dim. It's very hard to know how to detect it all. But we think they should be there because, as I say, from time to time, we see long-period comets coming into the solar system from somewhere. And you can keep on zooming out and zooming out and zooming out. And it takes a long, long time, almost a factor of about 10,000 relative to the outer solar system, before you get to the next nearest star. So that's just a reminder of how empty space is. This plot here then shows things on a scale of light years now. And it shows you the nearest stars that we know of. There's the sun in the middle, and there's just a random scattering of stars around us, most of which you've never heard of. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Groombridge 34, right? Nobody's ever even heard of Groombridge, including me. I can't remember. I think this was a proper motion catalog. My suspicion is that, therefore, Groombridge was an astronomer working on this in the 1960s, but I should look that up. So there are the stars around us. You can see almost nothing, almost entirely empty space. This will come up again right at the end of this talk. If we zoom out further, here, unfortunately, this shows on my screen, but not here, you would see a scattering of more stars around here. The little dots are not visible, but some of the names are in here. So they just look like they're uniformly distributed around us in space over scales of tens of light years, as I said. If you went out slightly further, you'd start to notice some structure to things. You would notice that there are regions like, say, the Orion Nebula, where we see a lot of hot gas and stars forming, and that those regions tend to be in certain directions on the sky. And those directions kind of form rough stripes. Although the contrast isn't as good as shown here. This is actually a sort of artist's impression. All these figures, by the way, are stolen from a fantastic website by Richard Powell. If you want the URLs for any of this, you can email me and I can provide them. It's called The Atlas of the Universe, and what's particularly impressive about this is that this guy, as far as I can tell, is just an amateur who's put all this together. But he's put together the best catalogs I've ever seen of nearby objects, right up to very large scales of superclusters of galaxies. Anyway, all these figures are from that site. And if you zoom out here, then this is what we imagine the large-scale distribution of stars around us will look like. This is our galaxy. The scale bar here is about 100,000 light years now. And there you see these various arms and features. We also have a couple of companions, and I mentioned that briefly later on in the talk. So as I say, some regions in this are not quite so empty. They have gas in them. You probably recognize this. The Morsehead Nebula. This is also a little bit of local promotion. This is an image from CFHT, the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope, which for many years was our main optical telescope as Canadian astronomers. We now actually have a pair of larger telescopes, the Gemini telescopes. But this telescope is still very nice because it is a very wide field of view. So they've installed on it cameras that cover very large patches of the sky by astronomical standards, that is to say about a degree or so. And you can make great big mosaics like this with that camera. So there's one of them. That's another one I like about here. This is a star-forming region. I'm here to talk about dark matter, of course, not all this luminous stuff. This, you might think, is dark matter, because it looks dark. You can see here clearly this is, well, maybe it's not so clear. It's clear to me that this is dark stuff blocking light behind it. It's not holes in the light distribution. I don't know if that's really obvious here, but you can sort of see that. You can also see these things have a kind of filamentary structure, especially up there. These are actually regions where stars form. Stars need to collapse down tremendously from the gas around them in order to form. And to do that, they need to be shielded from the surrounding thermal bath of radiation they're in, especially in a region like this where there's a lot of radiation you can see illuminating this gas. So they tend to form in very dense, dusty regions where the light's blocked out by dust. The dust is really actually more like soot. They're really macromolecules. They're typically mixtures of carbons and ices and so on, with hundreds or thousands of atoms in them. They're not really dust grains in the sense of the stuff under your bed, or at least under my bed. But they're interesting. Partly, they're a big source of a lot of the dust is carbon. And, you know, it's not a complete accident that carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, the three important biological elements, are particularly abundant in the galaxy for reasons you can ask me about later. Anyway, some of this is the carbon dust, but you know it's useful to light. Yep.
In an area that forms a solar system of mm-hmm. some sort, mm-hmm. there's going to start off being, you know, sort of a center of the of gravitational force where the star would eventually form. Of all that dust in the area that a solar system comes from, how much of it actually does form the actual solar system in question?
That's a good question. I think a lot of the dust never actually makes it in. These blobs are about the size of a solar system, you know, multiplied maybe by a factor of 10 or so. So you have to do a little more contracting and collapsing to get from here down to objects like our solar system. But we can see, especially in the infrared, in things like this, disks forming. And those disks are thought to be protoplanetary disks where planets come up. Some of the latest images even show trails within those disks where it looks like planets are starting to form. Those things, yeah, collapse maybe by about a factor of 10. The dust doesn't necessarily all go in. Typically, all the heavy elements are on the order of a few percent of the composition of any of the gas here. Almost all this gas, almost all of the universe is, the baryonic universe, is about three quarters hydrogen and a quarter helium by weight. So that's actually 12 to 1 if you do it by number of atoms. And then the other heavy elements are really a frosting on that. So on large scales, what does all this look like if you put it all together in galaxies? Well, this is actually M81, once again, a spread galaxy you can see in a small telescope. And this is roughly what we think the Milky Way would look like with these spiral arms, a bulge in the middle. We think our galaxy probably has a bit of a bar in the middle. That's a relatively new discovery, about maybe 10 years old now, but there's strong evidence for that bar. Bars almost pointing towards us, which is why it was hard to see. Anyway, and as I say, this scale is about 100,000 light years for a galaxy like ours. We can't, of course, get a view like this of our galaxy. If we took a satellite and launched it at the speed of light, it would take it on the order of, you know, several 100,000 years to get out to a place where it could take a snapshot like this. So we have to look at other galaxies to infer the properties of our own. Galaxies are, just as stars are the obvious thing to look at in our own galaxy, galaxies are the obvious things to look at in the universe. They're sort of our tracers of where the mass is. So, for instance, the Milky Way lives in a group of galaxies called the Local Group. It's one of the two big ones. There are two big galaxies, the Milky Way and Andromeda. There's a medium-sized galaxy, M33. And then there are about 30 or 40 very faint companions around us. And we're all fairly close together in space in the sense that there's then a bit of a gap in the distribution once you move to the next largest scale. All those galaxies are distributed over a scale of about a million or a few million light years now. And that's very much just our local little set of neighbors. That little cluster of neighbors lives in a thing called the local volume, which in turn has other groups of galaxies in it, other knots, with on the order of 20 or 30 galaxies in each of them, each of which would contain billions of stars. So many of these galaxies would be as big as the Milky Way. Sometimes you get really large clusters, as I say. I apologize for the scale of this. This thing here, which you can't probably read, is the Virgo cluster. It's the nearest cluster of galaxies, really massive structure. It's a few tens of, it's about 30 or 40 million light years away from us, and it's the nearest galaxy cluster. So that's one thing to get used to in all these figures. You're not, of course, seeing these objects simultaneously. You're actually seeing them at different times. You know, it's as if you checked library catalogs around the world, and the ones far away from you took a long time to get back to, and therefore you're really looking at their holdings as they were weeks or months or years ago, not right now. So it's the same here. We're actually seeing the Virgo cluster as it was 30 million years ago. If something happened in the Virgo cluster yesterday, we wouldn't know it for another 30 million years. So on these scales, you have to start thinking about that time delay. And then this, in turn, is only a very small part of the universe we know of, and even this is a sub-volume of what we can see. You can see on these largest scales, I should mention briefly, obviously you can get positions of things on the sky. The way you get the third coordinate to get a three-dimensional plot is using the expansion of the universe, Hubble's law, which gives you the distance to a galaxy in terms of how fast it's moving. I don't think I'll stop to explain that just now, but that might be a good question to ask if you want me to discuss that. So on this scale, we actually know fairly well what the distances to these galaxies are. And as a result, we can map out three-dimensional structures, which look roughly sort of filamentary. I'll show you some more detailed pictures of the three-dimensional distribution around us. This is now on scales of hundreds of millions or even billions of light years. And this, in turn, is within the volume we can see, which extends out to about 13 million light years. So that's what the universe looks like on large scales. Now, at this point, as I say, I'll go through some of this material a little bit faster because I think you may have discussed this before. I'll talk about where in all of this. So far, I've just mentioned luminous things, right? Galaxies, stars, glowing gas. All those we think are made of normal matter. And why is it we feel dark matter exists? Well, it comes from things like this. This is called the galaxy rotation curve. So let me go through and remind you of how this works. You go and look at a galaxy like, say, the Milky Way. Here's a nice picture. This is from the Hubble website. This, I think, was an image with ACS. Beautiful new camera of theirs, which died, sadly, a couple of months ago. Its electronics failed. You know, the space is a very harsh environment for these things. So they're planning a mission in which they have a number of things they have to do, and I think number three on the list is to try to fix the camera that made these pictures, which would be fantastic if they can get around to it. It's pretty dramatic for the astronauts, though, to do that. So here's a spiral galaxy, and you can see it looks like it's a pinwheel. It looks like it's rotating, just from the fact that they're sheer in the gas distribution as you go around this disk. You can, if you think it is rotating, then you can hope to measure that. How? Well, this, as I say, is 100,000 light years across. So even if the material is moving as fast as it could possibly move at the speed of light, this thing is going to go around, you know, 2 pi times 100,000 light years divided by the speed of light gives you 600,000 years. So you're not going to see this thing move much in even, say, an astronomer's lifetime. Basically, if you track... Yep.
I would have thought it spun the other way. Now, you get that comment all the time?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I think it probably does spin the other way. And I think what I did was reversed... I used to have these arrows going the other way, and then I realized the next slide I'm going to show you is of a spectrum, which is flipped the other way around. So yeah, I should probably actually go and fix that. I should say, just as an aside, and this is something you don't need to know, but these spiral arms move, but they don't move at the speed of the stars in the galaxy. These spiral arms are interesting mathematically, for people interested in traffic flow. They are the equivalent of traffic jams in the material in the galaxy. So the interesting thing about a traffic jam is that a traffic jam does not move at the same speed as cars. It moves more slowly. Cars go into the traffic jam, they slow down, and then when they get out of it, they accelerate. So the cars on average are moving faster than the traffic jam. They're moving through it, right? The traffic jam can move forward or backward or stay stationary. And in fact, you can have a traffic jam, the cause of which has vanished, right? Because you'll just have an overdensity of cars, people will have to slow down, and they'll speed up when they move out of it. So traffic jams are these odd things. They're examples of wave propagation in a medium that can be, you know, they can come from somewhere, somebody slowing down at one moment, and they can then exist for a very long time or propagate up and down. So these waves are exactly like that. They're regions where there's a bit more material. The stars slow down as a result. Well, first they're accelerated into them a little bit, but then as they leave, they're slowed down because there's a net gravitational force pulling more back than forward in the galaxy. And as a result, you get clumping material. And the reason you see them so clearly is that that effect of having a bit more material really compresses the material and really enhances star formation. So really what traces out spiral arms is, first of all, dust condensing into clouds and stars forming in those clouds. Anyway, so that's kind of interesting. But yes, I think you're right. I think it probably is rotating around the other way. But it does mean it's a little bit, you have to stop and think, which way, you know, which way is the spiral pattern moving? Is it moving forward or backwards? And it can also, the speed can vary quite a lot. You can sort of see from this it's not solid body rotation, right? The outer bits, the inner bits can wind up more relative to the outer bits and so on. So how would you measure this motion, given that the object's so big, it takes so long to go around, you can't see what's called proper motion, motion changes in position in the sky. You use the Doppler shift. So this bit's coming towards you, so it's blue shifted, this bit's moving away, it's red shifted. So you can think of the individual emitting atoms in the lines, emitting wavelengths of light, and if the crests are being emitted by something that's coming towards you, then you see them spaced closer together, so you see a shorter wavelength, right? And in the same in reverse for the material going away from you. What does this actually look like at the detector? I was pointing out the last time I gave this talk, this is a spectrum. In terms of observing time, astronomers actually spend almost all their observing time observing spectroscopically and taking spectra. But you can see, looking at a spectrum, why it is we don't show these images as our big, you know, exciting results. It's very hard to make something like this look exciting. It's also a little bit hard to understand what this image is. This is, in fact, it's a 2D image where the two directions on the image correspond to quite different things. This is position on the sky. But this is wavelength. So what you do is you take a slit, typically, and you place it across your galaxy. So it's like you're only sampling one row of the image. And because you only have one row, well, you've got the rest of the detector you can record the image on. You can spread it out in wavelength. So this axis is then the intensity of that one row across the image as a function of wavelength. And what you see is that one side of the image is shifted down to the red, and one side is shifted up to the blue. And that tells you that this thing here, if you identified what the rest frame wavelength of that line would be emitted in the lab, that it would be here, this side would be blue shifted, and this side would be red shifted. So this side would be moving towards you, this side would be moving away. And from that you can construct a rotation curve, which shows you speed, basically, as a function of distance from the center of the object. The object, I should say, the entire line is going to have a net redshift on average, because this galaxy is moving away from us, like almost all galaxies. That's just part of the expansion of the universe. There are only very few exceptions. The Andromeda galaxy, for instance, is actually moving towards us, but it's one of the few that is. Here again, I think you've gone through this already. The physics of this is pretty straightforward. You're in this rotating frame, this non-inertial frame. There's a net centrifugal force. I actually have to stop myself why it's v squared over r. I think I remembered why it's v squared over r there again. That's a possible question that people want to ask. The gravitational attraction is gmn over r squared. So you just have to equate those two things, and you get this equation for the velocity. Right? One of the r's cancels out here. The m cancels out. So in fact, this doesn't depend on, this is this neat thing about gravity, right? That's the basis of general relativity. It doesn't depend on the mass of the test particle experiencing it. It's just an acceleration. Masses cancel out. So what you get at the end of the day is a velocity that tells you the mass interior to it in the object.
What is the less than R symbol there?
Sorry, what's the
less than R symbol?
Ah, okay. Yeah, so that's a slightly technical point. What you're measuring is the mass interior to subradius. Yeah. This, by the way, assumes, for instance, a circular orbit in a spherical system. So it's not quite right for even for flattened disks. You have to correct for that slightly. There are some subtleties here. The motions of stars in our galaxy, we're going around at about 200, 220 kilometers a second. There's a little bit of scatter on top of that, on the order of about 10 kilometers a second locally. So in fact, our orbit isn't completely circular. And therefore, even there, you know, if you actually did this with the sun, there's a small correction there, because we're actually on a slightly eccentric orbit. And for instance, we're bobbing in and out of the plane, right, which you wouldn't do in a spherical system. A spherical system, the orbit would have to be in a plane, whereas the sun's orbit actually wiggles in and out of the plane because of the disk, basically. The galaxy does that. So there's some interesting subtleties in there, hidden in there. Here again, I think you've had an introduction to Vera Rubin, who was essentially the first person to really point out this uncomfortable fact that if you look at real galaxies, if you plot their rotation curve, have a very flat rotation curve. Whereas what you would get if you looked at, say, the solar system is a falling rotation curve. So here I've just put three different mass distributions for n interior to R. This one is a single point mass at the origin. This one is a system with constant density. So the mass, as you go out in radius, increases with volume. So this is R cubed. And this one is a sort of intermediate case, where you have a density that decreases with radius as R to the minus 2, and you wind up with mass growing slightly. And you see that if you had a constant density sphere, rotation curves would rise linearly. If you had a single point mass, like the solar system, they would drop. And if you had some intermediate case, you could get a flat system. But to do that, you would need a mass that kept on increasing as you went out to larger and larger radius. So when you see observationally, these are the observational data points measured, as I say, from Doppler shifts, just looking at the motion in this galaxy. When you plot this, and then you compare it to, let's say, all the visible mass you see in the disk of the galaxy, there's a problem. The problem is the visible mass, if it's made up of normal stars and gas, predicts that the velocity should drop off like this, whereas what you see continues to be flat long way out. And then there's some fun facts about Vera Rubin. Vera Rubin, actually, it turns out one of these fun facts is wrong. She wasn't actually the first woman to observe at Mount Palomar. She was the first woman to observe at Mount Palomar in her own name. I'm just trying to remember. Their name has gone out of my head. There was a couple who observed there prior to this, but they did it under a program where the man, you know, signed it under his name. So she was a pioneer in that respect. She found this amazing result and announced it, and of course it was widely hailed as wrong, and it took a long time for the community to realize they made a mistake there. Another astronomer you may have heard of in this session, Fritz Zwicky. This is kind of fun. This is actually, I figured out this photo was to be taken in the building I used to work in. I've never figured out quite where. Anyway, the theory is what he's saying here is, you know, this is everything I've done for my community, and what if they give me nothing? So, fun facts about Fritz Zwicky. He was generally agreed to be irascible. He was Swiss, and he was a physicist. So he was an irascible Swiss physicist. He doubled the number of known supernovae. One of the things about Fritz Zwicky was he did all sorts of things. He didn't just work on dark matter, which at the time seemed a crazy idea. He did all sorts of things in astronomy. He also did other things in physics. He worked on in other areas of physics. So sort of golden age from that point of view, a lot of cross-disciplinary work. He didn't really get on very well with his colleagues. So one of the stories is that he referred to his colleagues as spherical bastards because the idea was they looked like bastards seen from any point of view. So he also went and measured, I told you about the Virgo cluster. The Coma cluster is also a sort of closest example of. The Coma cluster is the closest big cluster of galaxies. It's big in the sense that it's one of the biggest clusters of galaxies in the universe, roughly speaking. I mean, there would be hundreds of other big clusters like it, but it's about as big a structure as you would want to look at. So I was telling you about how in measuring motion around a point mass, say, you can infer how much mass that thing has by just equating the centrifugal force with gravity. So you can do that in a disk, and in a disk it's nice because you have tracer particles really probing the potential at all radii, so you can make a nice rotation curve. With galaxy clusters, you can play the same trick. It's a little harder because now everything is orbiting around, just in random, you know, the orbits have random inclinations. It's like a swarm of bees all swarming around a central point. And the orbits are no longer necessarily circular. So you can't make that simplifying assumption. And also, of course, you can have orbits that are going towards you or orbits going away from you. So you see both redshifts and blueshifts everywhere throughout the cluster. So what you see is just a scatter, really, of velocities, some of them towards you, some away. The whole cluster, once again, like all galaxies, it's moving away from you, so there's a net redshift. But you see some scatter, some dispersion around that. And that's what's shown here. This is one of his plots of the dispersion, the histogram, which doesn't reproduce very well. There's a histogram in here of the actual distribution of galaxy, and then some models of some things that could be sort of Gaussians or slightly Gaussians with more or less kurtosis, more or less fourth moment to them. So the main point was you look at this cluster, you see a big spread in velocity. You can use, this is a fundamental result from sort of mathematical physics. It turns out with force laws, that go as 1 over some power of r, for complicated reasons that I don't quite remember. I went through this at some point in grad school. There's a theorem, there's a sort of statistical theorem that says that those systems, on average, have to balance between, if they're stable, have to balance between kinetic energy and potential energy, and that they do so in such a way that their kinetic energy at any given time is equal to -1/2 of their potential energy. So if you do this calculation for an orbit, say a circular orbit around a point mass, this holds exactly all the time. If you do it for a more complicated system, it doesn't hold exactly all the time for any individual particle in that system, but it holds on average. And it sort of makes sense that if the system had a lot of potential energy, it could transfer that into kinetic energy in its particles. It could accelerate. If it had a lot of kinetic energy, it could expand. So it sort of makes sense those two things balance out. You know, if you give the system more kinetic energy in a given potential, it will expand. If you drop the kinetic energy, it will contract. And there'll be some equilibrium point. And this is the equilibrium point. So this gives you a statistical way now of relating motion to the mass that generates the potential. And he found that for the coma cluster, the velocity dispersion is 1,200 kilometers a second. How much mass do you need? Well, if you take all the light, all the stars you see in the coma cluster, and you multiply them by the mass of the star, you know, per unit luminosity, then it turns out you only need 50 times more mass to get this dispersion of velocities, to generate a big enough potential to account for all the kinetic energy you see. So you can observe the kinetic energy, you can infer from it the potential energy, but there's a factor of 50 off between them. And even by astronomical standards, that's not good. Usually we like to get to within a factor of 2 or 3 of the right answer. So he actually suggested that this was due to some dark matter. The original article is in German, so he coined the term in German in 1933. So since then, I mean, so far I've been very glib about talking about luminous matter and dark matter. I haven't really told you what I meant by luminous matter. We usually, if we say something's visible, what we mean is it's visible in the optical. It's visible in the wavelengths of light that our eye is sensitive to. Astronomy has made great strides partly by extending to other wavelengths. If we look at the coma cluster, nowadays what we find is that part of the reason there's so much, well, what in the 1930s seemed dark matter in it is that there's a lot of matter in it that just doesn't emit optical light. So the reason it doesn't emit optical light is because of the way black body radiation behaves. Black body radiation is like the filament of a light bulb. This is one of the very few astronomy things I can actually do a desktop demonstration of when I teach this. So I have a light bulb, and it's to be a light bulb with a fairly strong filament. And it's in a stand or something, and there's a variac where I can vary the voltage. So I drive more or less current through it. And you can get down to the point where you just barely see the filament glow. So that means you're looking at something that's around maybe 3,000, 2,000 or 3,000 degrees. It's kind of neat that that filament's actually that hot. And then if you really turn it up, you can probably get up to maybe 10 or 20,000 degrees, and you see something that glows and looks discernibly white. It looks whiter than, or even slightly bluer than average light. So the average light we're used to comes from the sun. It's at a temperature of, the surface of the sun's at a temperature of about 6,000 degrees. Right? If you kept on turning up that knob until your filament was at millions of degrees, or tens of millions of degrees, it would emit in the X-ray. It would produce a little bit of visible light in the tail of the distribution of photons, but the peak would be in the X-ray. And that's what we see in the coma cluster if we look at it with X-ray satellites. This has to be done by satellite because, thankfully, our atmosphere stops the X-rays from reaching the surface of the Earth. It stops them almost immediately, right? Right at the top of the atmosphere. So here's an X-ray image of the coma cluster. This, I think, was done, yes, this was done by XMM, which is a fairly recent big European X-ray satellite, imaging satellite. And this is about on the same scale as this. I think this may be this galaxy here. So you see diffuse X-ray emission, especially around the galaxy, but also throughout the cluster. Whereas in the optical, you just see individual galaxies. This isn't a very pretty, it's actually hard to get pretty pictures of comets, such as, yeah?
So to be classified as dark matter, does that mean it's not emitting visible, or doesn't emit anywhere in the medium spectrum?
Nowadays, it means it doesn't emit anywhere, or almost anywhere, almost at all, yeah?
So is it the same as baryonic matter? Does baryonic matter emit better?
That's right. So this stuff that's emitting X-rays is baryonic. In fact, this is normal stuff. You can find lines in it from normal atoms. It turns out this is hydrogen and helium. Once again, it's just heated up to temperatures where we don't see it in the optical. You see, for instance, lines from iron, especially this highly ionized species of iron. If you go and weigh all this stuff, if you figure out how much it emits per unit mass, it accounts for about a factor of 5 or more of what was missing. So, in fact, part of the answer in clusters of galaxies is a lot of the material is there, it's just not emitting in the optical, and if you weigh it all up, you gain this big factor. But we're still off by, I mean, I said the deficit version was 50, we're still off by a factor of maybe 6 or 8 at least, or more, in the case of galaxy clusters. So, here again, another thing you may have heard of a little bit earlier in this session. What about another way of weighing things, because maybe there's some problem with our way of weighing material in these clusters. Well, one way of weighing objects is to measure how big a distortion they produce in space-time around them. Galaxy clusters are big enough, they produce a big enough distortion that they can take the effect you see around the sun during an eclipse, where the positions of stars appear to shift slightly. They can take that effect of bending light rays and amplify it to the point where they actually bend light rays completely around them so that if you place a source directly behind them, you'll see it on both sides of the galaxy cluster. You'll get multiple images. This is called strong gravitational lensing. The optics of it you can reproduce, for instance, with a wine glass. If you hold up a wine glass and you look at a point source, you'll see that point source stretched out into a ring if you align them perfectly, or into arcs if you vary the alignment slightly. And that is exactly what's happening in this cluster. This is a massive Abel cluster, Abel 1689, so this is one of a handful of really the most massive clusters in the universe. And it has these little things, they're not very visible on the screen. These little things that look like just scratches in the image, there's another one, these arcs. If you go and look at those arcs in detail, you find they have the spectral properties of galaxies, but they have the spectral properties of galaxies at much higher redshifts and therefore much larger distances from the galaxies in this cluster, which are here, these orange things. So in fact, that tells you they're behind the cluster. And you can actually find cases where a single structure is reproduced multiple times in the sense that all these little knots are at the same redshift and they have the same spectrum, but they're spread over very different parts of space. So this is quite a weird idea. This takes a very long path length. Gravitational lensing is weak enough. You need a path length almost the size of the visible part of the universe for it to work. So this only works for clusters that are quite far away from us, billions of light years away. They're deflecting things through a very shallow angle. If you put a massive body right beside you and hope to use it as a lens, it would have to have an inconceivably large mass, much larger than the Earth. So lensing gives us a different way of measuring the effects of, or the mass of structures and the effects of dark matter. This system, this is also a massive cluster, this has sort of become the poster child for this field. This is a result from about 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, so it's really quite recent. Let me go sort of walk you through it. This image is actually quite a complicated composite. Here is a galaxy cluster. You can tell because there are a bunch of orange galaxies in here. Clusters tend to have old galaxies with old stars in them. So here's one bit here, and oh, here's a little bit over here. So what's happening here? It's some sort of binary galaxy cluster. It's two clusters close together in space. That is an image in optical light from the Hubble Space Telescope. You can go and measure how much bending there is, indicating gravitational lensing, around this system. And this fuzzy blue stuff, this is not a map of any, this is not an image of any wavelength. This is a sort of map made using gravitational lensing to say, here's how much distortion there is in the images of background galaxies around this structure. So you go looking for things like those arcs I was showing you before. There's one there. That's an arc. So that's a strongly lensed galaxy image. But you also go looking for much more subtle arcs, which don't show up in individual galaxies. They just show up statistically. Statistically, if you measured the shapes of all the background galaxies around here, you'd find they were all slightly distorted, just by a few percent, slightly stretched out. In strong lenses, you can sometimes see this by eye. But for what's called weak lensing, it really only builds up statistically. You have to image hundreds or thousands of galaxies to see this effect. This map is made from counting up those statistics, and it tells you that the centers around which the images are distorted are here and here. So I told you in the case of coma, most of the mass is in gas. It's not actually in stars. The gas is about 5 times more mass than the stars do. But then it's emitting in the X-ray. So you have to go and look at clusters in the X-ray to know where the mass of normal baryonic matter is. So we did that here. Well, I shouldn't say we. This wasn't me. This was a group of people, Lincoln in particular. And this is where the emission is in the X-ray, this pink stuff. So that's puzzling. The normal material doesn't sit in this peak or this peak. It sits between them. And it also has this very odd structure. Most of it looks like it's all piled up on one side of this main bit of the cluster. And then this thing has this very sharp feature in the gas distribution and a real sort of dense knot of gas, bullet of gas, moving through it. So how do we interpret this? This, if you see this in a gaseous distribution, a sharp edge like that, that means you have a shock front. So So that means you have a disturbance, the wave that's moving through faster than the sound speed of the material. So the material can't recover from that disturbance fast enough. So you get stuff piling up, basically. It's like a sort of snowplow effect. So here is a shock from this material moving through gas here. So that tells you a couple of things. If you didn't know what was emitting this light, you would know right away that it's what's called collisional, right? Which basically means it feels pressure. It interacts with itself. To have a shock, two things have to be able to feel each other, feel a pressure force. Not everything in life, at least in astronomy, does feel pressure. For instance, galaxies don't feel pressure. If you took, and this is actually going to happen in a couple of billion years, so it's probably not worth waiting for, but our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy are moving towards each other. They're going to merge. That merger will send two objects with billions of stars in them, hundreds of billions of stars in them, at each other at high speed. And not one of those stars will hit another star. There's something like a 1% chance that one star in one galaxy will hit a star in the other galaxy. They're like swarms of bees. They just fly through each other. I've seen this actually on the Canadian note with hockey teams, too. Hockey teams where people are just learning to skate, and you launch an attack, and the teams set out, and there's the puck somewhere, and they just go through each other. Nobody can turn around or stop. So they just go through each other. Whoever winds up with the puck, you know, wins the game. So galaxies are like that. This material is not like that. This material feels pressure. So this is collisional material. That's okay. We know what this is. This is normal gas. We can tell from the spectrum of light it produces and so on. It's all consistent with being the gas that's usually in clusters. What does it tell us? It tells us this lump, this whole lump, has actually shot through this cluster. That's what you need to produce this shock. This shock actually tells you what velocity you need. If you model the temperature jump across this shock, you know basically how much energy you have to pump into this, and therefore what the velocity of the material is. But then there's this puzzling thing that the mass is actually ahead of the shock. So this material has actually moved through here, and it hasn't stopped to form the shock. It's kept on going. Well, that's perfectly understandable, because this stuff, galaxies and stars, is not collisionless. As I say, galaxies and galaxy clusters, the galaxies can move through each other like swarms of bees. Basically, they don't have a big enough cross-section to hit each other. So if the mass we inferred in these two blue blobs added up to the mass in the galaxies, this would make sense completely, this picture. We'd have collisionless things with collisional gas. We'd run them together. The gas would stick in a front here in the middle and produce this shock on one side, and the galaxies would just keep on going. In a sense, the amplitude of these two peaks in the lensing gives us a direct measure of the mass, not in the whole cluster, but in the collisionless part of the cluster. And that mass is huge. It's far bigger than what's in the stellar component. A factor of, once again, we're back here to factors of 50 or so. The stars are only a few percent of the mass of the cluster. Right? So these peaks are much, much bigger than you could ever get just adding up the star length. So that tells you that what produces the rest of the gravitational potential to bend the light must be collisionless matter. Okay, so now we're narrowing in on something. So we now know that most of the matter in the universe is dark, in the sense it doesn't emit light, it doesn't emit visible light, but it also doesn't emit in, say, the X-ray or the infrared or anywhere else we've looked. And it's collisionless. So it's collisionless dark matter. Another term you may hear is cold. If the dark matter had a lot of, if it was in some form where it had a lot of thermal velocity, as I was saying with the virial theorem, it would produce very extended structures. That velocity would support it against gravity. Knots like this, while they may look big on our scale, are tight enough, dense enough, that they tell us the material has to be what's called cold, which just means it doesn't have much random thermal motion in it. So in fact, the usual term for all this stuff is cold dark matter. Now I'm running behind a little bit, I'll mention this stuff in passing. This is quite a different angle on this. This is also fairly recent. So just last November, COBE, two of the principal scientists from COBE got a Nobel Prize. The microbe background has been very much in the news. COBE was a satellite that was launched, what is it now, 10 or 15 years ago? 89, whatever that is, almost 20 years ago now. Which first really confirmed the existence of microwave background, the sort of relic radiation from the Big Bang. More recently, part of the reason this has been in the news, is more recently we've had now this, I think I may actually, these are movies. There's been a more recent mission called WMAP, you may have heard of. WMAP, COBE was so successful that WMAP, you know, had a bit of money put into it, as a result of which they can afford fancy animations of the satellite. It's actually a very clever experiment from an experimental point of view. It's two telescopes, two microwave telescopes. Here they are back to back. These things are actually telescopes. That's the primary mirror. Secondary is in here. So the light comes in, bounces off this, and goes in here. The light is microwaves in this case. So these are related to things like, you know, cell phone towers and so on. It's two of these things back to back. They look at the sky, and they difference the signal. And you remember from your experimental physics courses that if you want to measure a very small signal, the way to do it is to set up a nulling experiment where by default you get zero, right? So if you're trying to measure, you know, a difference between two big things, you try to subtract from the other and measure zero. Not sort of an accurate way of doing it. That's what they're doing here. They're trying to measure fluctuations in the microwave background. So they actually take one signal and the other signal, and they subtract one from the other and measure differences in antenna temperature, basically, as they point around the sky. So differences in the number of photons they receive. And they do this way out at L2, in this point where the sun and the earth are both sort of behind them, so they don't ever run into the risk of looking at the sun. And what they produced out of all this was the original COBE map, so the almost 20-year-old map, which, as I say, just won a Nobel Prize. This is the updated WMAP map. You can see much finer angular resolution. There's also a lot less noise in this map, believe it or not. This thing across the middle is the plane of our galaxy. And the rest of this stuff, these are fluctuations in the radiation left over from the Big Bang. To do this, I should say, these fluctuations are one part in 100,000. So in fact, if you see the original map, it just looks like this big orange thing. This is a 3-degree surface, so it's a black body radiating at a little less than 3 degrees. If you subtract off that main component, there's a slight temperature excess on one part of the sky, a slight deficit on the other, which we interpret as our motion through the universe, which is a result of our motion around the sun, and the sun's motion around the galaxy's motion within the local group's motion towards the Virgo cluster, and so on. So it's a sum of all those motions. If you subtract this off, you get this. Here, as I say, is our galaxy. This is done in galactic coordinates. That's the plane of our galaxy. That's the galactic center. The galaxy has warm dust and various things in it that emit the microwave. But this stuff in the background, that's really the signal we're aiming for. That signal has, you can see, a sort of graininess to it, right? It looks like it's almost pixelated or something on some scale. And what's really been a whole industry for the past 10 years is to study the power spectrum of that graininess to see basically how much graininess there, or what the amplitude of fluctuations is on this surface as a function of scale. So you can imagine, for instance, if you look at newsprint and blow it up, eventually you'll hit a scale where you see those little dots, I forget what they're called, that the images are made of, right? So you see the image is irregular on some particular scale. The microwave background is irregular on a particular scale of about a degree or two. That's where you get the most fluctuations. On smaller scales, it damps out. This is this sort of shows a rather complicated plot of that those fluctuations as a function of scale. The interesting thing about this is it's very easy to make very accurate predictions of exactly what that spectrum should look like for a given composition of the universe. at early times, before there are any stars, galaxies, or any complicating factors. And this animation just shows you, as you vary the density of, in this case, baryonic, so normal matter, how you would expect wiggles in this plot, so you'd expect fluctuations appearing or disappearing at different scales. I think I also have, yeah, this one is how the fluctuation spectrum changes as the overall density of both normal plus dark matter changes, and you see the main effect here is it just bumps the spectrum up and down in how uneven things are. Basically, matter makes the universe uneven because it attracts itself through gravity. So these are the theories, the theoretical predictions.
Sorry, if the sum of normal and dark matter is less than 1, what's the
That's a good question. The answer is dark energy. Okay. So here's the answer. Here's the observation. The observation is these data points. The model is this red line. And you can see it's incredible agreement. You can't even see the error bars on most of these data points. They're so small. And they fall all exactly on the line except for that one there. And there are one or two other glitches. Some of these have been sorted out, actually. And they did a reprocessing of the data. The data from this is quite complicated because you have these two data streams looking at opposite parts of the sky. And you have to figure out which way you were looking. And then you cover that patch of the sky from many different directions. So you have to add them all together. So it was really a nightmare to reduce this and turn it into a nice map that you could look at. And some of the glitches that turned out come from that. But generally, you can see there's beautiful agreement between the data and the theory. And that allows you to measure particular quantities to incredibly high precision. This is totally new. This never existed in astronomy, even when I was a student. There was nothing we knew of that was measured this accurately. This is the total matter density of the universe. And this is the total density of normal matter. And the numbers don't matter so much. The main thing to notice is this is 0.02 something, and this is 0.13 something. So these differ by a factor of 6, at least 6 or 7. And these are measured from something that doesn't know about galaxy rotation curves or gravitational lensing or clusters or any of that. This is all the properties of the early universe, when there was matter and radiation, and it's all fluctuating, and it produced this different spectrum of fluctuations. So to me, this is actually one of the biggest arguments for dark matter. It's very hard to get around this. For instance, if you try to modify gravity, which is one alternative, this is quite a constraint. There are some theories that manage to get around this by putting in an extra component of mass of neutrinos or something, but it's quite hard to argue yourself out of data that's this accurate. And it's good because, you know, you do want, I mean, the burden of proof on a theory that says that most of the matter in the universe is in some invisible form that we've never encountered before, the burden of proof is high, right? So you really want these small error bars. Okay, so here's the summary of all this. I think I'll summarize this, and then I'll the rest of this is just some pictures and stuff, which you may or may not be interested in. Here's the summary of what we know. So we now know that the universe consists of stars, which we can see some of. We can see the bright ones. We can't see the faint ones, but we think they're there. For theoretical reasons, we can see some of the faint ones close to us. So we sort of think we know kind of where most of this stuff is. And then we know how many baryons there are from those wiggle plots. So we know that, in fact, the stars aren't all the baryons. Some of them are in gas. Most of them, it turns out, are in gas, in distributions of gas at temperatures that are very hard to see. I told you we can see stuff that's at millions of degrees. And we can see stuff that, like starlight, is at thousands of degrees. It's very hard to see things in the sort of 10,000 to 100,000 degree range. Gas, if it's in that range and at low densities, it just doesn't emit much stuff we can see. And it emits a little bit of the ultraviolet, which is not a very convenient wavelength range to say. We don't have a lot of good telescopes looking at that range. So we sort of think we kind of know where this stuff is, although we can't actually see most of it, about 3%. And then there's the dark matter, which by definition we can't see at all. And then there's this problem that, as you pointed out, that all these densities are in terms of a critical density for the universe. And we know from, it turns out that peak, that scale of the characteristic fluctuation of the microwave background, that's kind of our best constraint on what the total density of the universe is. That determines the whole geometry of everything we see. If the universe had less matter in it, it would bend light slightly differently between us and the microwave background. If it had more matter in it, it would bend it in a different way as well. So we can actually, when I say matter, shorthand for matter or radiation, right? P equals mc squared. In fact, shorthand for matter, radiation, or any other source of energy density. So you can think the universe, you know, suppose it's some big black glass ball with some index of refraction, and you take a pattern of squares that are exactly a millimeter apart or something and wrap it around the outside, and then you measure how big those appear to be, the distortion of the light rays going through the medium will tell you what the density of that medium is like, what the index of refraction is at each different time, how that changes. And from that argument, we know that the universe is almost exactly at the critical density to within a few percent, and there's a theoretical argument that's an unstable point. So if we think if we're close to there, it's probably exactly on that number. So we think we know how big this whole pie is, and we know how much of it's matter, and 3/4 of it has to be something else. So because nobody had a really good name for what this other stuff was, and we already had dark matter, somebody at some point decided to call it dark energy and thought that would be cool. Which is a totally misleading name, because it's not dark. I mean, dark matter is actually dark in some literal sense. This stuff is just, and we don't have very good models, at least in my department, for what this is. Here we, in the Perimeter Institute, we have very good models for what the dark energy is. And the only problem is we have too many of them. We have dozens and dozens of very good models for what it is. So there's a bit of a mismatch there. So, we also know, I mean, I told you we have this stuff we don't really know all of. This stuff we can't see, but we think we know about. This stuff we really can't see, but we're pretty sure it's there. This stuff we can't see and we don't really know about. It turns out we need one or two other things as well. In the early universe, you probably need an extra scalar field to drive inflation, which is what makes the universe much bigger than it should be. Inflation may actually need more than one scalar field. So there are really quite a few things out there we don't know about. But we sort of know they have to be there. Here's the summary. Everything fits nicely into a model where we know how much energy density there is in the universe. And almost all of it is in forms we can't detect. And a large chunk of it, the majority of it, is in forms we don't even have good physical models for. We don't know what kind of mathematical structure they are. So I study the dark matter partly because in all of this mess, it's the simplest stuff. We do at least know what matter is, and we know how it behaves. And we know, because we could tell if it didn't do this, we know the dark matter is collisionless, as I showed you with that cluster. And we know it's not electrically charged, because otherwise it would rip baryonic structures apart. So we know that all it can really do, we also know it doesn't bind into normal atomic nuclei. We know that all it can really do is interact through the weak force. That's the only force we really can't constrain. So dark matter can be weakly interacting and gravitating, and that's about it. It has to be gravitating. So as I say, with dark matter, we don't know what particular particle it is, but we do know a fair amount about its properties. With the other stuff, that's much more difficult. And as I say, I showed you evidence in clusters of galaxies and galaxies. There is some more local evidence for dark matter, basically in small galaxies. There's then no good evidence for dark matter on scales smaller than galaxies. So that's kind of what I work on. Let me go through this bit a little more quickly. These are pictures that are available, as I said, most of them on the web. This just shows you what happens if you take dark matter, what it actually does, given that it interacts gravitationally. this is a box that would be hundreds of millions of light years in size. Normally, a box like that, if you take it in the universe, would be expanding, right? The whole universe is expanding. This is a box where that expansion's been taken out. So it's being rescaled at every different stage in the universe to whatever the average scale of the universe is. So you're sort of looking at structure in relative terms here. Starting from a very early time, redshift up here, 28, that means the universe is about a 30th of its current size. So this would be a few hundred million years after the start of the universe. And this box, this is a very simple calculation. It's just a set of particles in a box just interacting through GMM over R squared. That's all. There aren't any baryons in this box, so there's no pressure, there's no physics, and so on. From that point of view, it's slightly unrealistic. It's not wildly unrealistic because the dark matter does dominate by a factor of 6 or so. There is a cosmological constant in here, which sort of reproduces as much as we know of the dark energy. So the background of expansion is okay, the gravity is okay. So this shows you roughly what should happen in the universe starting at early times, if it'll play. Oh, there we go. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? What's happening here is that regions, we know the universe isn't completely smooth to begin with, because we can see that in the microwave background. We can see some patches are hotter and colder, some are denser and less dense, but only by a very tiny amount, by 1 part in 10 to the 5. The amplitude of those fluctuations grows. If you go and do the math, you find it grows roughly linearly with the scale of the universe. So when the universe gets to be 1,000 times bigger than it was at the time of the microwave background, that is to say the present day, microwave backgrounds when the universe was 1,000 times smaller than it is now, when it grows to be 1,000 times bigger, those fluctuations, those large fluctuations in the background, are on the order of percent level fluctuations. So one region of the universe here will have 1% more of matter than this region over there. That's on very large scales. We think the spectrum of those fluctuations continues down to small scales. We can map out how the fluctuation strength depends on scale, and basically it looks like it's a straight line right at the edge of the plots we make. So if you put those conditions into this box, then you have some regions, like the region that forms this filament, that have slightly more material. So as the universe expands, they slow down that expansion a bit more, and that material stays put. And in relative terms, the amplitude of those fluctuations keeps growing, because the slow regions, the difference between the slow regions and the fast regions gets bigger and bigger as you go forward in time. In particular, empty regions, for instance, start expanding very fast. So in some sense, in relative terms, they're pushing the material towards the dense regions. The dense regions actually attract material so much they can recollapse and become bound gravitational objects. And therefore, you get lumps all over the place. But you also get strings, filaments, sheets, sort of complicated sponge-like structure. I actually have a nice, this is the same thing, just whoops. Try that again. This is the same thing rotating around. Just to show you, this is actually three-dimensional simulation, so you can go and zoom through and see all this structure forming in real time. And you see these lumps here, they assemble as sort of congregations of smaller lumps. Small lumps form first, and they merge together and form big lumps. That is an example of the logical extension of this technique to one of the world's largest supercomputers. This is an interesting view. It's actually a view you could never have of the universe. The scale here, this is in megaparsecs. Parsecs about 3 light years. So this is 500 million parsecs. So it's about 1,500 million light years. So it's 1.5 billion light years. That means, of course, if you actually saw this, if you saw this end at one time, you'd see this end as it was 1.5 billion years previously. So in fact, you'd never see a patch of the universe this size simultaneously. I mean, you never actually see any of the universe, right? We always see things with a slight time delay. It's just negligible because it's much shorter than any of the times we care about. So at these scales, it gets to be quite long. But if you could see the universe around us in a snapshot, this is what we think it would look like, this sort of sponge coffee kind of structure with the dark matter providing the kind of skeleton for everything. Does the real universe look like that? Well, this is kind of fun. I like this image. It's a little less sophisticated than the one that's coming after this, but I like this because this is something you could do yourself. This was before digital cameras. They had a device called the automatic plate measuring machine, which took photographic plates, which for years were the standard for imaging in astronomy, because a single photographic plate can give you, I think, the equivalent of about 600 dpi, so, you know, 600 dots per inch, something like that kind of resolution, over something this size. So if you compare that to how many pixels you have in your digital camera, it's a lot of pixels in a 1930s, you know, photographic plate. So for years, I mean, it's still the case that I think up until a couple of years ago, there was still at least one telescope that was doing photographic surveys of the sky, just because that was the only way they could cover enough area at fine enough resolution. The problem, of course, is you then wind up with an analog image, and what do you do with that if you have thousands of these images? So in this case, this was, I think, in the late 80s, they built a machine to scan these plates and digitize them. And they made a big digital sky survey of original photographic material. And they went through and then just counted galaxies in each little square on this great big survey. There are some holes in this survey where there are bright stars or where somebody broke a plate or something. But this covers about an eighth of the sky. So it's like, you know, if you imagine cutting the sky into kind of orange sections or something. This is one of these. The white regions, so the brightness shows you where galaxies are, and the color shows you how big or how bright those galaxies are on average in that pixel. So the white bits are nearby galaxies, and the reddish bit in the background is more distant stuff. And what you see is the universe is uniform on average in the reddish component, but then in the white component it has these structures, these lumps, and that these sort of trace filaments on the sky. And I like this because this is all stuff you could see with a small telescope. So you could, in principle, make this map yourself just with, you know, a pair of big binoculars or a small telescope and a lot of patience counting millions, hundreds of millions of galaxies. Nowadays, we have a better way of doing this, which is we don't just get images of sizes of galaxies. We actually go and measure redshifts for all of them. That's a huge technological undertaking. It takes on the order of 100 times longer to get a redshift for a galaxy than to get just a single brightness measurement, because you have to measure it different parts of the spectrum. So that's something that's only been possible more recently. But it allows you to see this image in 3D. Here's an example. This is one of the pioneering big surveys like this. You may have heard of the Sloan Sky Survey, which is took over from this one after this was finished and is a larger patch of the sky. This was 2D. This is two narrow wedges in the sky looking in one direction and the other. And so you're just taking a slice through the distribution of galaxies around us. And you can see, all this is luminous matter, but you can see that it traces out these kind of filaments and pockets and voids. So it really does look like those entirely theoretical models I was showing you of the kind of sponge toffee look to the universe. But that really does match where galaxies are in space. So here again, it's another reason to sort of believe that, you know, these models of dark matter are not completely crazy. Okay, the one last thing maybe I'll talk about is right in the middle of this, there's a knot. I'm going to zoom in on. So this describes reasonably the large scale structure of the universe. What about the small scale structure? Here's that knot blown up. Now, you might think if you blurred out your eyes and I changed the contrast slightly. I wonder if I can change the contrast slightly.
This is periodic matter or dark matter?
This is a simulation of dark matter. That didn't work. Okay, I was trying to turn down the contrast here. I'll show you. I actually later on have a movie of this fly through the same thing. This is all on the web. This is called the Millennium Simulation. It's the biggest of these simulations ever run. So this is all dark matter in this one. Here in the center, if you kind of blurred your eyes, you might think, okay, that kind of looks like something like the coma cluster I was showing you, or the bullet cluster. If you imagine a galaxy corresponding to each of these lumps of dark matter, you can imagine this is kind of a galaxy cluster. Maybe there's a central galaxy here. Galaxy clusters do have central dominant galaxies in their cores. Maybe here's another little cluster beside it. You can imagine bright galaxies here. But you can see this doesn't really look like the maps of the sky I was showing you on very small scales. It kind of seems to have more lumps in it on small scales, lumps we don't see. We don't see all this fine structure. It looks like light traces dark matter on large scales, but not on small scales. So it's a bit puzzling. What happens on scales smaller than galaxies? And that's a new research topic that people haven't thought about much. So that was my complete digression on the small scale. So oops, let me just go back here. So how do you figure out what happens on small scales? With these simulations, you can start off with a smaller box, if you want, and figure out the gravitational dynamics. And everything scales nicely. There's one restriction. I showed you great big structures assembling galaxy cluster scale things in that big Millennium simulation. Once those things start assembling, well, you need a big enough box to contain all the material that's going to wind up to model that formation cell consistently. You know, it would be like trying to simulate the formation of the solar system and only having an Earth mass worth of material. Clearly, you just can't do it consistently, right? So your box has to be as big as the biggest thing you want to see form. And that means if you want to look at what happens in the universe on small scales, you have to stop early on in the history of the universe, because after that, bigger things start forming and they just take over. So this actually stops at a redshift of 26, this simulation, which is probably before any galaxies ever formed. And what it tells you as a result is not how the normal matter is distributed, but how the dark matter is distributed on even smaller scales, at least at that time. And then since then, we've had a big fight with the authors. This is your demon, who's also Swiss, now in California. He was just a grad student when he did this, actually. He doesn't look at all like Fritz Vick. He's tall and bald. And a shaved head. Anyway, they took a box. This box is about a few thousand light years on the side, the whole box. And they did a simulation, and they found structure that looks remarkably like the structure on the much larger simulations I was showing you. So then they played the same trick again of saying, well, let's go to a smaller box and stop even earlier. So then they modeled this little box and stopped earlier. And then they went to a sub-box of that, and they eventually found the smallest lump of dark matter, right at the bottom of the scale of structure. The thing that sets the limit here is the properties of the particle you assume for dark matter. So at this point, the particle physics becomes relevant. This thing has about the mass of Mars. So we've gone down from the Milky Way, which is 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 solar masses of material, to down here, 10 to the minus 6 solar masses of material. So we've gone almost 20 orders of magnitude in resolution. You can see why, if you calculate what 10 to the power of 20 cubed is, because that's 10 to the power of 60, that's a lot of particles. You can't put those in a computer again.
This thing that's the mass of Mars, how wide is it in space?
That's a very good question. So their conclusion, let me just get to that in a second. Their conclusion from this is our galaxy is full of these things. If you figure out how many lumps there would be about 10 to the 15 of these lumps of dark matter floating around us all the time. And they'd have the masses of planets. So they'd be scattered, for instance, they'd be going through our solar system the whole time. So how big would these things be? Well, they scale in a very nice way. They scale, they have densities that make sense if you compare the scalings to the densities of large dark matter structures. This thing would be about a hundredth of a parsec in size, which is about the size of the outer bit of our solar system. And the authors of this paper just wrote this up, this result, and said, you know, this is great. This, our galaxy is full of these things, and here's how big they are. And at some point, a number of authors, including myself, pointed out that, wait a minute, that's rather odd. You're saying you have a planetary mass spread out over something that's the size of the whole part of our solar, you know, all the bit of our solar system with planets in it. Well, there's much more than the mass of Mars in that volume. And it's packed into very tight, you know, things. They're like little ball bearings compared to this big diffuse cloud of material. So these things would get completely shredded if they came close to our solar system by tidal forces. They're much, much more diffuse than the mass we know of, the normal baryonic. So the normal baryonic mass here is incredibly concentrated relative to its mean density in the universe, basically because it could get rid of its kinetic energy by emitting photons, and therefore it can sink into denser and denser things. Galaxies, for instance, are hundreds of thousands of times denser than the universe around them. And we, in turn, are much, much denser than the average density of material in our galaxy. These things are denser than our galaxy on average, but they're much less dense than the solar system. So that was a kind of technical point. I'll just flip to my picture of this. This is a picture which convinced me that I should really go and hire an artist to do pictures, because I'm not that good with Photoshop or whatever this was. Anyway, here's my attempt to draw our solar system. The sun and the inner planets are actually just in this little bit. Here I've drawn something which is supposed to look kind of like the Oort cloud, just for scale. But we're moving around our galaxy. We're sitting on the rotation curve, you know, moving around about 220 kilometers a second. And as we go along, well, we come close to these things, which are the scale of the solar system, to its, maybe out to the Oort cloud or so, these lumps. But these lumps are very diffuse, and they're getting completely shredded every time they go by a normal star. So in fact, they wouldn't be condensed lumps of material at all. They'd be long streams of debris that would be hundreds or thousands of light years long. And they wouldn't, as a result of being shredded out that way, be that much denser than the dark matter around us. So this, as I say, very crude and ugly drawing is my best estimate of what the dark matter really locally around us looks like. It's this very diffuse structure with streams in it. Here on Earth, it doesn't add up to much. So if you do the calculation, this is a 2-liter bottle. So this probably, for typical dark matter candidates, this would have about 2 dark matter particles in it at any given time. Moving at roughly 100, 200 kilometers a second. So they wouldn't spend a long time in this Coke bottle. They would move through and be replaced by others. So the dark matter going through our bodies and through this room is very diffuse. And that's why we don't notice it. And it's also why it's incredibly complicated to detect in the lab. So that's the one last bit of this. I'll skip over some of this and just get to what I was talking about, some of the hopes we have in the future for detecting this stuff soon. One of them scheduled for launch, this slide has just been revised within the past couple of weeks, originally scheduled for launch in October. I was getting very excited. Now, unfortunately, if you check the NASA webpage, they have a nice webpage where they list all the launches, and they show you there's a little picture of the rocket ship they're going to launch stuff in each time. Rather cool page. Unfortunately, the launch dates have little symbols beside them, which, if you look at them, are all rather pessimistic. So this one's now announced for January 31st, 2008. And if you look at the little symbol beside it and go and find the fine print, it says no earlier than. So it may yet get delayed a little bit. This is basically a huge chunk of lab equipment. It's not a very telegenic satellite, called GLASS. But it will detect very, very high energy photons, gamma rays that go right through this detector, most of them leaving trails of ionization. In some cases, they get stopped in the back here, and you can measure their energy. It is hoped that occasionally, while dark matter doesn't, as a general rule, like to emit light, that it can occasionally emit light, basically by annihilating with itself. So some particles, for instance, photons, are their own antiparticle. You can take two photons and run them together and produce a particle and antiparticle pair, right? So in some of the models for dark matter, it's the same. The particle winds up being its own antiparticle. So it's not very densely packed in astronomical structures. The chance of it getting close enough to another dark matter particle to interact is small, but there's a small chance that it will do that in annihilate and produce gamma rays. Either, if you're really lucky, it will produce just two gamma rays. So you're really lucky if it does that, because then the energy of the gamma ray gives you the rest mass energy of the dark matter particle right away. You just read it off the graph, there it is. If you're less lucky, and this is the more common situation, it'll produce particles called pions, which then decay, and they produce a very broad spectrum. But you can still, from that, get information about the mass of the dark matter particle, and you certainly get information about what type of particle it would be. So this is one hope, as I say, maybe for next spring. We may be hearing results. It'll probably take a year or two after this is launched, if all goes well, to see from this satellite, possibly annihilation from the center of our galaxy at these very high energies. This is a second experiment I really like. I should flash directly to the main view of it. It's actually a series of experiments. There's one called Amanda. This is IceCube. This is a neutrino detector. Neutrinos also, like dark matter, they go through almost everything. They're just weakly interacting. They're not charged. They don't even have a mass. It's very hard to stop. So if you figure out how big a detector you need to stop neutrinos in any big number, the answer is about a kilometer on the side. And one way you could look for them is looking for photons they produce as they go through material, producing what's called Cherenkov radiation, which is what you get in sort of nuclear reactor pools, that glowing blue light. It's the light relativistic particles make as they go through media. So they were thinking, where do you find a kilometer on a side sized detector that's transparent, that you can wire up to look for neutrinos? So one thing you can do is go to the bottom of the ocean, where the water's relatively stable. There are experiments at the bottom of the Mediterranean, for instance, to do this. This was tried off, I think, Hawaii some years ago. Didn't quite work out, but anyway, there are new attempts to do this. This is really mind-bending. This is an experiment where somebody at some point realized that if you put ice under enough pressure, it actually becomes transparent. I still find this hard to believe. I really wish they could get a webcam and send it down one of their shafts so we could see this in practice. But the claim is that under the Antarctic ice cap, because it's under so much pressure, if you go a few hundred meters down, the ice is actually transparent over kilometers. So you can put in it a little detector that basically just looks for flashes of light from relativistic particles going through. And that's what they've done here. They've got this string of things that are like hanging like a bead curtain. They're actually looking for events that go this way. They're looking for events that come through the Earth and happen to stop in this sort of flash in this kilometer of ice. There's so much junk that can make it through the atmosphere, it turns out, that you have to ignore all that. All sorts of other particles can make it through the atmosphere. But not much can make it through the entire Earth. Right? You really need neutrinos to do that, or some other weakly interacting particle. And there's the Eiffel Tower scale. The other scale bar I really like on this is the individual photodetectors, it turns out, are about the size of a penguin. I don't know whether that was intentional or not. Anyway, there they are putting it in place. So that's another way we could look for very high, unusual high-energy events. Once again, neutrinos could be a byproduct of decays or annihilation of very massive particles in space. This is the Canadian content portion of this. I think you've heard a little bit about this. This is Snow Lab. So this is a refitting of the Sudbury neutrino experiment, which was, for years, a very successful neutrino detector. It was using a giant acrylic sphere full of heavy water to detect neutrinos. That's now been emptied out. And that same site is being used for lab experiments to try to detect collisions between individual dark matter particles and the lab apparatus. Those are very rare. You need a very cold system to record the energy from those events. I think, as I said, you've heard a bit about some of those experiments. It's actually a site that will be used for multiple different. These are called direct detection experiments because you actually get the dark matter particle itself, unlike, say, the neutrino experiments or GLAST, which is just seeing a byproduct. And then finally, this is kind of the competition. As astronomers, we always, slight antagonism towards the particle physics community. We always like to feel it'd be nice to do things astrophysically and not have the particle physicists beat us to it. Of course, the other way of finding dark matter is to make it in the lab. And to do that, well, you need collisions that provide you with enough energy to get to the mass of the particles, which we think is in the hundreds of GeV to TeV range. So that's a lot of electron volts. Currently, we're up at around 50 or 100 GeV with the last generation of accelerators. There's this thing called the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which will start operating in CERN. And once again, the date moved recently. They had some problems with their magnets. The date is now May, I think, 2008. There's one of the teams, I think, that just completed the beam line in that picture. I was looking for what the date was. I actually downloaded. This is a PDF document, which if you printed it out at a resolution you could read is about this size, which is their timeline for doing this. This is the management document. And all these tiny little completely illegible things are all the different things that have to happen to get LHC to work. There are thousands of people involved in this. And I think they've got to here, and I'm not sure whether the blips here mean things are running ahead or behind, but anyway. That's just an indication of what's involved in that effort. Yeah.
Even if they do make it, some dark matter particles, what's the point of doing that if you can't detect them at CERN?
Right. That's a good question. So typically, the way you find these things is by sort of looking for their absence. For instance, with neutrinos were discovered by noticing missing energy in beta decays. And that energy had a spectrum which told you what, in that case it's a massless particle. In the case of dark matter, you'd need some minimum amount of energy, and what you'd notice was that once you had events over some energy threshold, occasionally they would be missing a big chunk of energy in particles you didn't see. So they would probably, yes, just stream out of your detector. That's right. In principle, you could hope to see them stop. I don't think LHC has any instrument that would actually know if that happened. In principle, you could have a recoil event where they hit a nucleus in the rest of the apparatus. But I think it'll be from energy events. So anyway, that's
presentation. So we're running a little bit late. We have time for one quick question formally, and then hopefully we can convince James to stay a little bit behind if there are any more questions informally. So the other thing you asked, you
mentioned that in 1 2 liter pothole there'd be about 2 particles. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, is that enough density within our solar system that it should affect the velocities of our own planets? Or is it insignificant compared to the density of dark matter in the galaxy?
Mm-hmm. That's another very good question, and it's a very contentious topic. So there's this thing called the Pioneer anomaly. The Pioneer satellites were sent out of our solar system. I think originally they were launched in the 70s. They produced, you may remember from about 15, 20 years ago, the photos of Jupiter and Saturn and so on. And they're still going. I'm actually thinking of Voyager. Pioneer was even before that. So both Pioneer and Voyager, they're still going, those satellites. We're not going to get them back. So they're heading out of our solar system. And Pioneer in particular, because it was made in the days before fancy electronics, when they made stuff to last, the electronics, space missions was much, much better in the 60s than it is now, when we have all this high-tech surface-mounted small junk that easily gets zapped by radiation. So it was sturdy enough that the Pioneer satellites are still sending back signals, and you can track their deceleration as they leave the solar system and the mass behind them slows them down a bit. And it's not quite what you'd expect. It's off a little bit. And there have, for the past number of years, there's actually a whole panel devoted to discussing this, and John Moffat is one of the people here who works on modified gravity, I think, is on that panel, you know, trying to see what that tells us about gravity locally. In principle, it's right at the edge of where you could measure dark matter in our solar system, but it would be difficult to do. You'd be measuring, I mean, I was showing you even those dense lumps, you're measuring something like the mass of Mars having an effect over, you know, going out to the orbit of Pluto. So it's a hard measurement to do. But yeah, that is definitely, that's one of the best constraints on modifications of gravity and local.
Okay, if we could thank James again.